Hey everyone, producer Jeff here with some quick housekeeping. Today's episode is actually part one of a two-part episode that we'll be releasing today and tomorrow. It's a conversation with the brilliant minds behind the Oscar-nominated animated short film War Is Over, which is perfectly timed because the Oscars are this Sunday. So this conversation with three of the creators was so packed with amazing stuff, we decided to break it up into two parts. So today we're mostly going to be chatting about the specifics of the short, how it came together, and then tomorrow is more of the state of the animated film industry as a whole, how emerging technologies are giving more access to creators, and how all of that is impacting the creative process in general. So it's an amazing conversation. We didn't want to cut anything, so we're actually going to be breaking it up into two parts so you can get the most bang for your buck. So for today, enjoy part one and make sure you don't miss part two tomorrow.
Hey everyone, welcome back to the show. I'm Meg LaFauve.
And I'm Lorianne McKenna.
And today we're welcoming three of the brilliant creatives behind the Oscar-nominated short film War Is Over. Producer Brad Booker, writer-director Dave Mullins, and singer-songwriter Sean Ono Lennon. Brad and Dave are animation experts. Brad has produced hits like Rumble and The Book of Life, the latter earning him nominations and five Annie Awards.
And Dave is a 20-year veteran of Pixar and worked on hits like Up and Soul. And his directorial debut, Lou, earned him an Oscar nomination for Best Animated Short Film in 2018. In 2020, the duo founded Electro League, a real-time animation studio redefining the way storytellers approach this medium. They're joined by Sean Ono Lennon, who, in addition to being an award-winning musician and music producer, is a co-writer and executive producer on this short film.
Now, before we jump into the show, let's have each of you introduce yourselves so our listeners can know who you are during our conversation.
Hi, I'm Brad Booker.
Hi, I'm Dave Mullins.
Hi, I'm Sean Ono Lennon.
Well, hi, Brad, Dave, and Sean. Welcome to the show. We're really excited to have you here and talk about your short War Is Over. Before we get started, I am going to talk about how we're going to talk about spoilers on this show. So, audience, if you haven't seen it... please go see it, and you can listen to the episode and then watch it, but I'm going to be talking about things that actually happen in it. And I also want to say how stunning this movie is. I've been in animation, as you guys know, for a pretty long time, and I was just so not just moved but gaspy through a lot of it. There are just so many specific moments. The animation was so subtle and complex. The set design was amazing. The color script is gorgeous. And little moments like the soldier walking in blood filling his footsteps, and the violence in it was brutal, but I couldn't look away. I was making myself watch it. But it was small. It didn't feel like a massive it taking up the whole screen. And I knew, here's the spoiler, I knew the bird was going to die because I'd heard about it. But when it happened, I fucking gasped so loud. My husband thought I had fallen down. And then, of course,
I had this. The storytelling is amazing. The storytelling is really special.
And then, like, the emotional connection you have to all those characters so quickly. And there's just this beauty. And the music, of course, right? The music carries it all the way through. And I'm just, it's a work of art. And I, as Brad, you and I've worked closely together in animation. I don't say that very often.
She doesn't. Right?
I don't walk around going like, that's customer. A work of art.
Well, thanks for saying that. It's
So congratulations. Awesome. I mean, just I could talk about this the whole hour. I'm not going to, of course, probably not. But I was stunned. I think it was stunning. And I can't quite get over how beautiful it was and how much it meant to me to have that experience, knowing people I knew got to work on it and created it. And just really thank you.
And congratulations on the Oscar nomination and the Annie, you guys. Spectacular.
Thank you.
Awesome. Thank you very much.
Wild ride.
So do people usually cry right off the bat when they're on your podcast? Because I'm about to cry.
No, usually I'm the one crying.
Coming from you guys is so huge. Yeah.
I'm the one who's usually crying. And I was like, I'm not going to cry on this episode when I talk about the movie, the short that you guys made. But really, I mean, really just amazing. But okay. So we're going to stop that part now.
Let's get into it now.
How did this idea come about? Like, how did you guys, the three of you, come together to decide to make?
That's
well, I can say the initial spark was Universal Music asked me if we could do a like a music video for a Happy Christmas War Is Over. And I spent some time trying to work something out. I tried to come up with some treatments and I got a bunch of treatments submitted and they were all very professional and, you know, well-intentioned, but I just never found interest in any of them. It just felt kind of boring, not because the filmmakers weren't great, but because it was just like, it was really just visual accompaniment to the song. And I felt like the song was so famous, I didn't feel that I needed these visuals to listen to the song. So that was when I thought, well, maybe I should reach out to my friend. Oh, I reached out to Adam Gates because I just did the Beanpole record with him. I'd put it out on my label. And I thought maybe he might help me do something narrative, basically, because I was like, well, a music video seems kind of dull. So, you know, maybe we could do a short film and use the song as like score to a story. And that's when he said, well, I can't do anything, but my friend Dave Mullins just started this production company, Electra League. It's independent with Brad and you should talk to him. And then we met. And the first day I met Dave, we got along really well. And we came up with the basic infrastructure of the story right away. So we knew that we had a kind of, we had something to work with and it moved very quickly from there.
Yeah. And I always kind of describe it and it's kind of funny, but it's like dating, you know, like when you meet creatively, if you're going to mesh with somebody, like there's like your pheromones and hormones all kind of work together and like they match. All the moans match. And, you know, Sean, what was really great, cause you know, I called after Sean, Adam reached out and this idea, you know, I immediately called Brad and said, hey, you know, it was pitched to me as a music video. And, you know, Brad and I both are focused on narrative storytelling, not necessarily, you know, visual poetry for music. And, you know, we both decided that the song, you know, the song is really important. You have to chase down every lead, you know, as you guys know, like you take every meeting and see what happens with it. But right off the bat, Sean said, no, you know, I want to do a short film around this. I want to do a narrative story. And we immediately just dove into what the song meant to you, Sean, what it meant to me, what, you know, some of the great things about talking to Sean right off the bat, which really helped inform what we were going to do with the story, was this idea that John and Yoko had made this perennial song that has this like candy wrapper of a Christmas song. But in the core, in the soul of it is an anti-war protest song against the Vietnam War at the time, because it was written in 1971. And, you know, that was so interesting to me because it's very hard to put those two elements together. You have Christmas and this idea of anti-war together. And that was, we didn't want to, especially Sean, you know, Sean, you'd said that, like, you know, we don't want to focus on the Christmas side of this. We really want to focus on the anti-war side of it. And so you still have to get enough of the Christmas idea in there, but we wanted to really make it accessible to everybody. So anybody around the world can watch it and they could look at this and say, oh, this is a statement about war, not a war, a specific war. And we could kind of get into how we approach trying to generalize the war. So it's more of a general statement about war and not just a particular conflict. But we immediately started talking about what the story meant to us. You know, the sort of the short version of it is in the first meeting, we had already come up with this idea of, okay, we're going to make a statement about war and like, how do we want to make a statement about that? Well, we both, you know, Sean and I both felt really strongly that, you know, the idea that like, if people could just stop and talk and come together and really connect with each other, that a lot of the conflict around the world would probably be resolved, because you find that, like, you know, everybody here, everybody around the world, they care about their family, they care about their children, their parents, their siblings, whatever. And if we could get sort of trick the soldiers into connecting on a human level, then the war itself would kind of lose its importance in the story. And so that was the first question, is like, how do we get soldiers on the opposite side of a war to connect? And that's where like the springboard from that, where a lot of the ideas came from.
I ask, this is, you know, we talk a lot on the show about lava, the sort of touching, the emotional core of what something is. What was it that you guys connected to about what the song means to each of you, right? Sean, you have a very specific connection to the song, right? And Dave, you have a different experience. And Brad, all of us have a different connection. So like, what was it where you found that, like, all the moans that they connected?
And that it could go and translate into this beautiful story that you came.
Yeah.
I'm not exactly sure how to frame this, but in terms of the emotion of the story, I felt like the important thing was to make people feel something very strongly. And, you know, my intention was working on the story with Dave that I wanted to make people cry when Icarus dies, because I felt like that was the best way to open people up to receive the message once you hear the song, because you've heard the song a million times, most people, or many times, right? And it's easy to sort of shut your brain off when you hear something that you've heard many times, or when you see something that you've seen many times. You can kind of just, you're not really paying attention to it.
You know, the thing that we talked about early on was that, you know, what really is the cost of war? It's the loss of innocent life. Clearly, it's the loss of all life in war, whether you're a combatant or not. And so this idea that we need an innocent in the film to really drive it home. And the, you know, the idea of Icarus, which was our pigeon, she came out of this idea of like, well, okay, so let's we both love chess, and his parents have a, you know, a connection with chess that Sean can talk about. I have a personal connection with it, but we decided that chess would be a great metaphor for war, you know, pawns in a war, soldiers are pawns in a war. And it's like, okay, if we could get them playing a game, they don't know that they're playing each other necessarily. How would they play a game across, you know, borders? And it's like, well, a carrier pigeon would be a fantastic idea. And so when you get to the carrier pigeon idea in the war, you go, okay, now that's going to put us in like World War One or earlier. And so we wanted to bring the conflict as close as possible to where we are today. Like, we didn't want to do like Rome or something like that, you know, the Roman Empire. So that kind of put us in a World War One alternative. And, you know, the thing with the pigeon was, we really thought of her as our main character. She is the one that's delivering the message of peace. She's the one that's connecting the soldiers. She's the one that, you know, we're kind of following emotionally. And she was the one that we knew we would have to kill to really make the point about what the cost of war was. And when we met with, you know, Peter Jackson was involved in this, obviously, you know, he was a huge part of this, but when we pitched him the he had the script, and the first follow-up meeting we had with him, that was his one question. His only question really was, do you have to kill the bird? And, you know, my response to him was, well, if we don't kill the bird, we're not really making a statement about how innocence is lost in the war. And we are trying to do that because you know, we see war films all the time, and sure, they can absolutely be emotional, but if you really want to reach everybody, it has to be the pigeon. It has to be an innocent. And that's what's really going to hit people. And it's not to do that to be manipulative, because we thought and talked about that a lot. We did it to make a point. And once I sort of explained it to him, he's like, yeah, okay, makes sense. Yeah, I get why you're going there. And, you know, Brad, you can talk to about this too. You know, there's multiple moments in the film, you know, where that question kept coming at us. Do you have to do this? Do you have to do this? And we're like, yes, we have to go there.
We actually, our editor, John Carr, who is obviously very seasoned, was at DreamWorks for years and many movies before that, but he had a really hard time with it. He just kept saying, I just don't understand why you have to kill the pigeon. He eventually got it and was on board with us, and was always on board with us. Like, you know, he just, is, of course, is going to speak his mind. But I just think people have, it's crazy that people have more, they definitely have more of an issue with killing an animal than they do with killing a human being.
Oh, for sure. As a writer, if you kill a dog, there's no going back. That character, no saving that character who kills the dog.
So, yes, we definitely dealt with it many times. But, you know, I'm sure Dave would say the same, but I would literally get super defensive over it, because I'm just like, my job is to protect that part of the film, because I really did believe that without it, the film's flat. There's just no way to build tension. You know, maybe there is with humans being in harm's way, but I just, for us, it was always the pigeon, and I just fought for it every step. And, you know, the crazy thing is, and, you know, even Dave talking about Peter, it's like we had no, this was like the dream project. You know, usually you've got 14 cooks in the kitchen. We had nobody. It was us. And we had to seek out, you know, our brain trust and get people to, you know, get those fresh eyes on it, because we didn't have the normal executive review. I mean, aside from the beginning discussions with Peter, there was no oversight. And Peter was not never in a position that he wanted to demand that we do one thing or another. He was really trying to just help us as a filmmaking team, and by offering up Weta, but we had nobody that ever challenged us, because we still don't have a distributor for the film. We hope to have one by the end of the year, but we got to make the film we wanted to make. And, you know, we've worked on some really cool projects, all of us, I think, in our career, but this is one that we're just super proud of, because it was us. Like, if it sucked, it was us. If it's great, it's us. Like, we're pretty naked in this whole thing. You can't blame it on the executive level above you. It's right. You know, we're full kimono on this one.
I felt very, very nervous about the whole thing, because I had never done a project like this. And frankly, I don't think there has been a project like this. I mean, I can't really think of any catalog artist who have come out with a new kind of short story film that's kind of in lieu of a promotional video clip or whatever, or a music video. So it's kind of an odd project. And I was really nervous going into it. And throughout the whole project, it was something that I felt a lot of pressure in terms of having taken the risk to do it. But obviously now it's really paid off. And one of the things that I really was amazing, I mean, there were so many coincidences in terms of overlap, in terms of taste and ideas for Dave and Brad and I. I mean, we really share a lot of thinking on a lot of things, not just in terms of art, but in terms of life in general. And one of the things they said early on that I was really interested in kind of talking about was how, when I grew up, films like Bambi or films that were made for young adults really challenged you and sort of prepared you for, you know, the dangers of life. And I feel like, as you know, but it's also true, I used to talk about like going to the playground in Central Park, like, you know, you could break your arm and, you know, you'd go to the hospital and get a cast. Whereas now everyone's so scared of a kid hurting themselves. They're all like padded up and, you know, they've got helmets and gear just to go roller skating or something. And I understand it, but it's interesting because in a way I feel like we're doing that for film and art as well. We're sort of really trying to protect kids from even ideas that might be uncomfortable. And I think that's really doing a disservice to an entire generation. So one of the things I really liked talking to Dave and Brad was they were saying, you know, now that we have our own company, we really believe in that too. Like, that basically we want to push the limits of like what is today considered, you know, something that kids can handle. Because, you know, at the same time as we're sort of trying to coddle a generation more than ever, we're also like seeing that kids are more mature than they've ever been. I mean, they're being exposed to ideas that I never knew anything about. I mean, in terms of life and adult things. And but at the same time, we're kind of trying to condescend to them more, which seems like a divergence that really makes no sense. And so I really felt strongly that the team was really right, because we all had this feeling of like, no, I mean, we want to tell a message of peace, and it has to have gravitas, and the stakes have to be high. And yeah, it's going to be a cartoon, meaning it's a format that's traditionally meant for younger people, but we feel like it's necessary to make it tough to watch. And you know, and frankly, I think that's really important. And I think the filmmakers who are working in the space who think that way are actually my favorite. I mean, you know, whether it's like Puss in Boots 2 or your guys' films, there are certain people who make, you know, I guess CGI or family films that still manage to put in like very complex issues that, you know, might be challenging. But I think that's, I think we shouldn't condescend to young people. So that's part of the reason that we all got along. I mean, you mentioned early on the bloody footprint. That was Dave's idea from the get-go. He just had this vision of it in this first script. And, you know, it's not the kind of thing that maybe he would have been, it would have been easy to do if he was, you know, if Brad and he weren't in charge of their own studio. So that was something that we really were aware of going through it. And we took the risk and we decided to kind of stick by our vision for it. And, you know, hopefully there will be a place for it, as Brad says, you know, in terms of like a streaming service or something. But
now when you're doing a film as creators, writers, that there's no dialogue. And I think that people could think, well, then there's no script, right? People do this to me all the time. It makes me crazy. Like, they're like, what's your favorite moment of film? I'm like, oh, when they cut her hand off, when they cut her finger off and the piano. And they're like, well, that's not writing. I'm like, what are you talking about? Of course,
right. That's interesting.
Yeah, it's weird that people think writing's dialogue. I don't understand it. So can you talk a little bit about the process of writing something that has no dialogue, that's going to be animated, bringing in board artists? Were you the board artist? You don't use storyboards. What was the process?
Can I just say before that want Dave to answer this question, but that just made me think of one thing that I think is bad in terms of being an actor too, is actors who just kind of wait for their line. Cause it's almost as if like all the stuff between their line and after their line is not the scene. And it's like, well, actually the line is just 1 millisecond, you know, or 1 10-second in a scene that might be 3 minutes. The entire time you're acting. So I think it's really interesting you say that, because I think it goes for misunderstanding film in general. You know, it's not just the words. I mean, the words, in fact, are the least important thing if it's a great film traditionally, right? They say you should be able to watch a film with the sound off. But anyway, yeah, Dave and...
No, but that's really important to me as a writer. I'm always about, what are they doing? What is the behavior? Especially when you're in animation. Nobody wants to animate lips moving. Like, it's got to be what... So I'm very, very interested in how this came about and how you and Sean as a writer participated in that.
Well, yeah, Dave's very conscious of the inner dialogue, which is so cool. And I really learned a lot from him talking about that.
Yeah, I mean, you know, what was really kind of unusual about this, and you know, whether it's a short or it's a feature, there's always a lot of development that goes into it. And what was really unusual about this is Sean and I met for two, maybe hour and a half sessions. By the end of that, we had an outline. And I went home that night and I wrote like an 11-page, 10-page screenplay out of that just... describing all the scenes, like you're saying, you know, there's no dialogue, but there's tons of screenplay to sort of describe what's going on. And the process of that, you know, it's what you're writing without dialogue. And so trying to get vision, like what's in my head visually of how to tell the story and get all those beats on the page so that we can like, then like really sit down with it and, you know, really tear into it. It's funny that you mentioned the bloody footprint shot, because that was one of the first visuals I had for the film. And I don't know if you guys do this or not, but when I'm thinking of, like, my favorite films are when, you know, like Miyazaki does this lot where he takes two primal elements. Like there will be like, you know, a bad example is like, oh, there's a burnout car. You've got fire and car. And like those two primal elements just visually tell an entire story, or a burnout house, or whatever, it's a plane underwater. It like tells this story with just those two elements. And so for me, when I'm writing, I'm always trying to figure out, okay, what are the primal elements that really sum up the story? And obviously on a feature film, there's much more of those elements involved. But for this, I was trying to sum up the film in one shot. And that idea of blood and snow, you know, you have this pristine snow, the footprint comes in. When the general, you know, when the sergeant's footprint pulls away, the blood seeps in from underneath, and it tells the story of like, oh my God, this conflict has been going on for so long. It's frigid cold. The guys are coughing, and in that one shot, you set up the sergeant's role, his relationship to the other soldiers, what the soldiers are feeling, how long the conflict's been going on, Icarus flying overhead, and like for me, that was the first shot in my head, and so that was in the original script. And, you know, at a certain point we were dealing with some budgetary things where we were trying to get the film to an 8.5-minute film, which obviously it didn't turn out that way. I think we're more like a 10 and a half minute run time for Image. And that was one of the babies we had to pull out. And I was trying to be the good boy and go, okay, okay, like, you know, like, okay, we're gonna pull it out for now, right?
Don't you understand the importance?
Okay. If I remember correctly, nobody asked you to take it out. You took it out on your own, like a big boy would. He killed his own baby.
We had a 10-minute film. We're trying to get out to.
Okay, but why did you? Why was that the shot? Like, that sounds like the genesis. Like, it's the visual language of the film. Why was it that? Why was that not enough part of the story that you were like, I'm not going to die on this hill today? What made you pull it out?
Because the other parts of the relationship between soldiers, how the story resolved, like all of those were like essential. And this was, if I'm putting my big boy, you know, pants on and going, what can I absolutely not live without? Like, I couldn't live without Icarus being shot. I couldn't live without them playing, you know, like, so you go through that and you go, okay, I'm going to take out a minute and a half or 2 minutes of the film. What's got to go? And I reluctantly did it, but you know, Brad, you should speak to that.
Yeah, I mean, like, there was some complexity issues in that section too that we were dealing with. That section actually became longer as time went on, because we felt it needed to. And I mean, to credit Weta, they, you know, were super stringent. Like, we need to keep it around X amount of minutes. I don't remember exactly what it was, and it kept growing. And finally, I think they just realized in the process that, yeah, this thing needs to be a little bit longer, and they figured out a way to do it. So, but when Dave cut it, I just was like, I was proud of him for doing it, because, you know, having worked with people like Brad Bird, they do it all the time.
No, but it is a really important part of being an artist and a storyteller, is willing to try those things so that we really do need it. I mean, in Inside Out, that moment where mom talks to her and says, thanks for being our happy girl, got cut because people are like, we're not going to like her. And I'm like, you're not supposed to. Yeah. Like, people don't like to be disturbed, right? But it's like, yes, it's disturbing. It should be disturbing. So I love that.
People say I think people say they don't like to be disturbed. And I think in honesty, if you're going to watch a film that's going to affect you, you have to be disturbed. You know, at least if the subject matter is, I think, somewhat serious. Like, like you're saying, those scenes are so important.
I feel like it depends which hat you're wearing. Like, if you're an audience member, you want to go through all sorts of a roller coaster and you want the biggest ups and downs possible. But if you're like looking at budgets and advertisers and that kind of stuff, then you're like, maybe we shouldn't take this risk. You know, it's like, it depends which lens you're viewing the whole thing through. But it's really interesting what you were talking about, Dave, in terms of the footprint shot that you thought of. And there's a few shots in the film that are really visually metaphorical, like that he had from the beginning, which is, there's this also the shot at the end when the soldiers kind of superimpose into the chess piece, which I just thought was so brilliant. And those are examples to me really of like why Dave is absolutely a director, because when I was younger, I did actually take some film classes, and I remember reading an essay by one of my favorite directors, this guy Juzo Itami, who probably one of the most famous Japanese directors. He did a film called Tampopo, and he wrote an essay on what being a director is. And he basically said, you know, if you have a script where there's a newlywed couple and they've just had their wedding, and they're waking up, the first day of their whatever marriage, like, a director's job is to basically figure out, like, what is that shot? Like, how do you tell the entire story? You know, you could have 10 directors who would do it in a different way. Do you open on like the wedding dresses, like, you know, on the floor or something, or do you open like with the couple in bed? Like, there's so many ways to tell the exact same story. That was really, I'll never forget that. He's such a genius, that director. And when I started working with Dave and he started having ideas like that, that are really like visual ways of non-verbally kind of encapsulating several elements of a story, I think that's really interesting. And it made me wonder, like, is there something about being in animation that makes you think more filmically than, you know, a lot of directors? Because you're basically coming up with the image from scratch, you're having to draw it. So you're already thinking in a kind of visual metaphor because cartoons are, you know, more of a metaphor for people than an actual photograph of a person. So, I mean, it's interesting because I feel like really good animation in a way ticks the boxes of what I would consider great filmmaking more than a lot of films, live action, they call it, live action films.
And I'll just add to that in that, you know, this is where having a really great producer comes into play. Like, I always say that, like, Brad is a producer that thinks like a director, and I'm kind of a director that thinks like a producer. And that's why, you know, our all of our moans kind of work together, all of our pheromones work together. But in the
just so you know, I'm not going to put that on a t-shirt. Do our moans
work together?
I'm not doing it. That's not a t-shirt or a mug. It's not happening.
The pheromones, the hormones, and the Ramones.
I'll put the Ramones on a t-shirt. No problem.
But not the Ramones.
No.
But, you know, the thing about that was, you know, in the script, I had written the last shot, and I said, you know, we do this big booming shot, and what we reveal is the battlefield looks somewhat like a chess set, and that's where we ended. And I had thought of like, oh, can we show the battlefield as a chess set? And it was Brad's idea actually to, you know, I forget when the last shot came in, but we had the battlefield coming up, and then we were on just a still shot of the empty battlefield outside with the birds flying. And Brad's idea was like, well, we're already doing booming out. Like, why don't you just boom out and completely match move the battlefield to the chess set? And I was just like, it's just one of those moments where like we all work together so well creatively. Like, we really are a team that, you know, it's just moments like that I'm so glad to be working with Brad and Sean. And there's so many moments like that. And it's rare. I won't say it's rare, but it's such a special relationship when you get that. So I have to give I have to give props to Brad.
Absolutely.
Okay. I want to talk about the game engine that you used and how it is how it is different from traditional animation. I get very excited about this. I've worked in a similar engine property on an animation project, and it's so fucking exciting. So I want to hear you guys talk about that and where and if storyboarding comes into play, or how you're moving from script straight into production.
Specifically for this story too, like why did mm-hmm. you think that would be good for this particular story, you know, in terms of the visuals and what it brought to your thematic?
Well, I think the reality is the whole company of Electro League was founded on that idea, because me, you know, I was an animator for years. So I went to art school. I think like an artist, but I've also worn the producing hat. So I can look at it both ways. And for me, I think storyboarding is a beautiful art form. And I think it's served very well to the animation process for years and years and years. But again, a respectful, but I just, having spent time down on the Avatar stage with a buddy of mine, Richie Bainham, watching that whole thing, and Richie came from 2D animation and, you know, did both 2D and 3D on Iron Giant back in the day with me, and he evangelized this process for animation, and I could never get my head wrapped around it. And part of it is because I think in animation and even live action filmmaking, it's really more like stage, because you're thinking everything's a shot. So this shot and that shot, and you go to the next shot. And what we're doing on stage now, you know, when we capture the blocking, is we're capturing sequences. And you're not even, the crazy thing is you're not even worried. I mean, Dave always says, well, you might not, but you're not really worried about camera. And I think as Dave gets more into this process, he won't be either, because you have the faith that you're going to go later and get every shot you need. That's the whole part of this. It's like, you know, it was like when we used to draw traditionally and you had to erase your drawings, and then you started working digitally and it took a while to figure out like, oh, I can be more brave here because I can just hit Control Z and undo that last thing I did. And that's the way we think about with this. It's all about iterations. It's like, you know, my big frustration always was that it took 6 months at the minimum to get from, you know, when you finish a screenplay to getting the first set of reels up, because you're waiting on the board artists to bring stuff in. And in the case of this process, we, I think, have proven through the numbers that we can put a film up in, you know, 30 to 45 days, not unlike a live action shoot.
Can you describe the process for someone like me who really does this, having a what do you do? You said you're on a stage. Can you describe it a little bit?
It's basically, if you've ever seen any of the behind the scenes, and we have some of our own stuff that we did for this, but if you've ever seen behind the scenes of Avatar, you know, you have people using performance capture and you've got actors. We worked with a really talented group of actors when we were given the Avatar stage for 7 days. I mean, I feel like we buried the lead a couple times here on that part of the story, but after we got Weta on board and their close relationship with Lightstorm on Avatar, then my friends at Lightstorm were like, well, if you guys are working with them, then you've got to shoot it here on the Avatar stage. So anyway, we got 7 days in the middle.
I mean, obviously.
Yeah, obviously.
That happens all the time. Yeah.
But in the summer, summer of 22, we got 5 days for principal capture, and then we had another 2 days later, like 2 weeks later for cameras. But you basically have this crew, this amazing six actors that worked on Avatar. They're kind of like, you know, the second, the body double almost to the big actors. But this guy, Kevin Dorman, and his crew are just amazing. And they wear, you know, the performance capture suits with the tracking balls. You know, there's like 215 cameras all around the big soundstage, and you're capturing, you know, their movements in 3D coordinate space. And then that goes into the computer. And then 2 weeks later, we load the takes up, because we, you know, like on a live action set, your script soup is writing down which shots Dave liked the best. We go back 2 weeks later, and then you just have a very small group of people. And that's what's amazing about this process. Instead of having 600 people working on a film simultaneously, we can make it with people on the stage for the most part. You know, like, there are times where you balloon up here and there, but at any given time, the director, Dave, is surrounded by this group of support. And, you know, we had 10 people during principal capture. And then when we went back for cameras, there were two guys operating on stage. And we had, the other thing that I think is amazing about this process is, you know, editorials like this black box, and, you know, they're in editorial. Nobody ever gets to go to editorial. It's like this sacred space. Well, we've taken editorial and moved it onto the stage. So in the subsequent passes of this, when we've, you know, gotten the first set of reels up, we go in and look at stage two, stage three, stage four, and you're plugging holes at that point. You're able to call up your sequence. Okay, this shot's not working. We need to get this one. We need to change the camera on that shot. And you're literally capturing it, and the two operators are sending it over to our editorial guy on stage in real time. So it's an amazing process.
And are you still working, you're taking that motion capture, and are you still working with background artists and character designers? So all of that's still happening. Yeah. It's just happening in a different way. Is that right? So you still need artists. You still have to have the artists coming in. Yes.
Yeah. The front end is still like, you have to wait for the assets to be built. That's the thing we can't speed up right now so much, is you have to model the characters. You have to rig the characters. You have to build at least rough representations of the environments. And then once you have that, then you've got a box of Legos, and then it's just filmmaking in its purest form. And you're literally inside the Unreal Engine. You're seeing your characters with approximated textures and lighting on them. It may not be final quality, but it's amazing. 80% of the way there, and you get to judge your film in real time. Yeah, and then, you know, on this film in particular, we rendered stuff, and then it was sent to comp. They did some comp tricks on it and stuff, because you are rendering frames in the end. Like, we aren't trying to have real time play. You know, we're not trying to play the film in real time for people. But it's exciting, and it's
eliminates the preciousness around some of it. Preciousness. I remember Pixar, if an animation shot ever had to be cut, it was like the director and the whole production crew would go down to animation and break the news to the person who animated the shot. And it was like this big hardcore moment. You know, it's expensive, but also it took years to get to that moment. And then it was like this, it was an event, like a funeral kind of thing. It was traumatic.
Yeah.
Trying to take
I've been to a lot of those funerals.
Our motto is fail early and iterate often.
Yeah. So with this process, like, there's more iteration. You can like, okay, that shot didn't work. Let's go back and do it again. Or there's a different camera. Or so it's less, there's less preciousness because there was less invested in that to get to that place.
You're sketching, right, Dave?
Yeah. And, you know, what I was going to say is that, you know, it's, you know, come, you know, I've had people sort of describe me as an animation purist, you know, as a Pixar for 20 years, as a Disney before that, as an animator. And, you know, it was a big point that Brad and I had to discuss as he was bringing me on to Electro League, was that we were going to be working in this way. It was hard for me to get my head around. But being an independent studio, it really helps us with this idea of get it up and iterate and do it as quickly as possible. And I think before this film, I had done a little bit of virtual camera work, haven't worked too much with motion capture, but after this experience, you know, working directly with the actors is like work, you know, for me is like the same conversations I'd have with the animators. We're talking about interior monologue, posing, silhouette, all that. And I'm keeping that track of that in my head, how I want the shots to be. But after this, having done this, after having the experience of shooting the performances and going later to shoot the V-cam, because we were walking on the stage and we had a Antonio Riestra, who was our live action DP. As we were walking on the stage, the health and services people came up and said, Antonio, you have COVID. And so he had to go home that day and I got to operate the V-cam, the virtual cam. And it was amazingly freeing. Like there's a couple of examples that I point to sometimes where we had the charging shot. And so it's all handheld. We didn't have tracks or anything in there. Everything was handheld. And I was trying to get this tracking whip pan shot of them going by, and I just couldn't get it. And the one of the guys in the back is like, I can slow the shot down by 50%. I was like, yeah, let's do it. And I did it and I got the shot and it's like, this is great. I could slow it down and really get what I needed. And then, you know, it's all jittery and everything else. And like, well, we can smooth that out for you. And then you end up with these great shots. And then like, you could shrink down the set to a tenth of the size. So if you want to get a booming shot, I'm just like standing there doing this. And it's like a sandbox.
You have to describe your motion for our listening audience. Use your writing, directing skills.
Describe
that motion.
So I'm just pulling my hands up slowly from the floor with the V-cam, and we're getting this giant, you know, booming shot that's showing hundreds and hundreds of shoulders. And I'm just moving my hands like, you know, a foot or two. And so that was really eye-opening to me. And look, I'm, you know, before we go from like stage to, before we go from script to stage, I'm always going to have my sketchbook. I'm always going to sketch out my shots. It's always going to be there. I'm always going to discuss that with the DP. We're always going to have that conversation. But this idea of storyboarding, which on this film, we could not get our assets up quick enough. So we did have some boards on this film just to get us into editorial. It wasn't ideal for what we want to do, but it was a little bit, I think Brad would call it my crutch on the film, that we had boards, but it served a purpose for a good 6 months or so. Having done this experience all the way through, because once we have the performances and the cameras, we go into animation and we treat it just like animation. So for me now, it's not a scary thing anymore. And I feel like, okay, this is just, we're just getting the film up and we are going to get all the performances, we're going to get all the animation, we're going to get all the silhouettes, we're going to get everything that we need and polish. But going from script to stage is just awesome.
All right, everyone. We hope you enjoyed part one of this amazing conversation. And again, make sure you don't miss part two tomorrow.